I'm very happy now to welcome Stephanie Forrest. She is a distinguished professor of computer science at the University of New Mexico and external faculty at the Santa Fe Institute, and she will be delivering the 2013 Stanislaw Ulam Memorial Lecture Series, sponsored by the Santa Fe Institute, this Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday, September 10th, 11th, and 12th, at the James A. Little Theater here in Santa Fe. It's called Complexity and the Biology of Computation. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So you work at this amazing intersection between computer science and biology. So for those of us who are just not computer scientists at all, do computers and computer networks actually have the properties of living organisms?
They have some of the properties of living organisms. And over the past 20 or 30 years since I've been in computer science, I argue that computer science and our computer networks have become more biological. There are many examples I can give of that. The kinds of properties that have intrigued me about computer science and biology and where I see parallels are the fact that biological systems are completely distributed and autonomous.
What does that mean?
That means that each behaving organism in the environment is behaving according to its own program or its own genome or its own inputs, and not under the control of, at least I believe it's not under the control of, a centralized, omniscient.
Right. So the king of the jungle isn't telling the mice what to do.
Exactly. Exactly. And computing has become more distributed and more autonomous over the past 20 years. So our original computer programs had a single thread of control and only manipulated a single, atomic unit of data at a time. Once we built computer networks and developed multi-core chips and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, we find the computational world is much more distributed in the sense that we have more independent computers or semi-independent computers operating at the same time.
So, I mean, what it sounds like is that for whatever reason, computers and technology have evolved to be ever more like natural ecosystems.
Yes. And we actually see that in the language that people use to think about computing. If you go back and look at what we said in the 60s or the 70s or the 80s, it was more about the intelligent brain. And now we talk about viruses and all kinds of other biological lingo.
What are other biological lingo, like circulatory system? I mean, when you think about the flow of data.
I'm a little less comfortable with thinking about networks as only circulatory systems for a variety of reasons, one of which is circulatory systems rely on a heart, a single heart that pumps material around. But certainly, we have this idea of resource distribution networks, and that covers both circulatory systems, like a vascular system in a mammal, and computer networks that deliver information to nodes.
I suppose the nervous system would probably be a more apt metaphor anyway.
Many people like to think of computing as just a big brain and a big, giant nervous system, and that's a very reasonable analogy. I've always been interested in the biological, I call it a perspective, not an analogy, because there are other properties of biological systems that I think are relevant to computing. And these are things like diversity. In the biological world, we see all this wonderful diversity, diversity of species, diversity of individuals within a species, diversity of different ecosystems. And it's my contention that the computer world is starting to look more like that than it did 30 years ago. Also, biological systems are very robust to failures. And that's also a property that the nervous system has. The nervous system, after all, is also a biological system.
Right. Now, diversity, biodiversity, is one of the things that keeps ecosystems healthy, that keeps groups healthy. We all know the story of the Irish potato famine, which was caused because there was only one kind of potato in all of Ireland, whereas in Peru, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of different kinds of potatoes, and if one gets eaten by a certain kind of insect, all the rest survive. The same principle applies in computing?
Yes, I believe it does, and many other people believe it does. I guess it was in the 1990s when we first started seeing what are called worms, these little computer programs that were self-replicating and were transmitted around the internet in the beginning as attachments to email messages.
Worms, there's another biological.
There's another biological analysis. The computer scientists, by the way, ultimately decided it was too hard to tell the difference between a virus and a worm and a bacteria, and so we now use the phrase malware to just cover all those bad things that might happen on a computer.
Right. Software, that, malware.
Yes.
Badware.
Exactly. But getting back to the diversity story, the reason those early network attacks were so successful is because most people on the internet were using the same operating system and using the same kind of mail program to read their email and storing their list of addresses, email addresses for their friends, in the same file that had the same name. And so these worms took advantage of that, just like the bugs that led to the Irish potato famine. And so the question is, on the one hand, there's this trade-off in technology between economies of scale and this concern over loss of diversity. And so one of the areas that I worked on and that I'll be describing in my lecture is this question of how you could engineer systems, computer systems, to be diverse from the perspective of the attacking malware, but still let all the users have a familiar interface and have the computers essentially work the same way in terms of computing answers.
And there are many ways, presumably, to do that. Maybe the simplest being having lots of different names for things or kinds of files.
Right. So one thing you might think of doing is having every computer be painted a different color. That's probably not likely to have much impact on disrupting the attacks because it's not changing the internals of the computer.
Are you just literally physically painted a different color?
Yes. I mean, you could imagine that. That's not a serious proposal, but it highlights the fact that you need the diversity to be engineered in at the level of the computer that is relevant for the attack.
Now, is that actually happening now? Like, we all have these Macintosh computers or Dell computers or whatever. Is that diversity built in?
Yes. As a default, on many operating systems, there is a capability known as address space randomization. And that is probably running on your computer right now.
And that protects from these kinds of attacks. Where do these attacks come from? Who's doing them? What's their motivation?
So in the beginning being the 1970s and most of the 80s, the people who wrote what were then called computer viruses, and they were, if anyone can remember back that long, they were spread primarily through floppy disks.
I remember
because
those,
people
yes.
didn't communicate via the internet, because the internet was not yet then the internet, although there were precursors of it. And those were really primarily computer hobbyists, and the idea of attacking a computer, writing a little virus that could send out a funny message or something like that, was viewed as a challenge and a game and something fun.
So it was the equivalent of a prank.
Yes, yes. And some people from other countries used to write these viruses as ways to communicate potential employers, often in the U.S., that they were serious computer programmers. So that was kind of phase one. Then phase two, once money came to the internet and we started having e-commerce and financial transactions and things like that, people then started developing attacks for the purpose of, for example, stealing credit card numbers and actually making money.
That's going on to this day.
That still goes on to this day, and some of the pranks still go on to this day. It's the second thing that came along, or one thing that came along, were these email messages or spam attacks from places in like the poor person in Nigeria who inherited a lot of money and needs a way to transfer the money to his aunt in the United States who lacks a bank account or whatever.
And you, lucky you.
Lucky you, the victim, get to help in this process. And so we still see those kinds of attacks today. There were a lot of these financial attacks and these social engineering attacks. Once the web became prevalent, the phishing attacks are you receive an email from your bank that says there's been a problem with the account and you need to reset your password. Please just click here and enter your password and then make a new password. But it actually wasn't your bank who sent that message.
And now they have your password.
It was the phisher, spelled P-H-I-S-H. Then they have your password. They can go to your bank and take your money. So we've had those kinds of attacks and lots of variations on them. And then what's happened over the past 10 years, or become more publicized over the past 10 years, are now these so-called nation-state attacks, where government agents, for one reason or another, are either trying to spy — that's probably been going on for a long time — or, as in the case of Stuxnet, want to actually attack another country's capabilities using some form of the computer.
You hear sometimes, I mean, these stories about a 15-year-old in Belarus or something getting into the Pentagon computer system.
Right.
What is that, a prank? I mean, just because we can?
I don't know. I guess that's the straight answer. I think in many cases, when people are caught, it's a much safer thing to say that it was a prank than that they were doing it on behalf of either some criminal organization or on behalf of a nation state. But I don't really know.
We're talking to computer scientist Stephanie Forrest. So we have all these attacks of the kind that you just described, and just as we have immune systems, people who are doing security work for computer networks and so on are setting up the equivalent of immune systems for whatever their client is, whether it be a university or a government or a bank or the entire internet. Again, getting to the intersection between biology and computer science, can you actually make inoculations, vaccines, the equivalent of antibiotics, things like that?
That's not a yes or no question. It's not a question that I can give a yes or no answer to. The first piece of technology that we can argue is that was developed by computer scientists that is a legitimate analogy to what the immune system does is what's known as an intrusion detection system. The original forms of protection were these virus detectors, which you may remember were marketed by various antivirus companies. The idea was you had your PC and they would sell you a database of these virus signatures, and you would install that on your computer. And then every time you opened a file, it would check for you to see if that file had been infected with this virus by checking the signature. That is somewhat — I always used to say that is like having an immune system that can only protect you against the diseases you've been vaccinated against, because it only protects you against the particular viruses that are already known and exposed to the world.
Whereas people are continually creating new ones.
Right. And those are often referred to as zero-day attacks. So when these new forms of attack show up, you need a different kind of detection mechanism to recognize them. And that class of systems in the computer security world is known as an intrusion detection system. And that's very much like the way an immune system works, where you have these cells patrolling the body looking for novel foreign patterns that it doesn't know about. And when it finds them, they are tagged as being suspicious. And then in my computer science language, I would say, then some additional processing and checking is done before a decision is made to try to eliminate.
And so in that sense, they really do function very much like the human immune system.
Yes, although all the details are different.
Is the immune system an inspiration for people who are writing these things? In other words, do people study white blood cells and how they work and use those to help them think of how to find computer malware?
So that's a good way of describing 10 or 15 years of my research career. So it's a specialized part of the computer security field. There is a small community of us who are interested in what real immune systems do, trying to abstract those mechanisms and designs to a level where we can translate them into computer algorithms that work using the same principles. And we've had a remarkable amount of success doing that. Most people in computer security don't think about biology explicitly. But I would argue that the kinds of computer security solutions that are being developed have come to look a little bit more like biological systems over the years.
That's so interesting. It's like people who are doing biomimicry in mechanical technologies.
Exactly, exactly.
So what do? You actually work with biologists and say, how does a lizard's immune system work or a dog's immune system work? I mean, you're...
Yes, that's exactly what I do. The first big hurdle in immunology from a computer scientist perspective is mastering all the four-syllable words. Because the immune system is enormously complex and consists of many, many, many different kinds of cells and molecules. And just mastering the vocabulary and the terminology is overwhelming.
What are some of those four-syllable words?
Well, lymphocyte is probably a three-syllable word. That's one that most people have heard about. And then there's all kinds of specific receptors and specific kinds of cytokines. And interferon is another example. Interferon, that's four syllable.
Does your work, when you're intersecting with these biologists, does it then help their thinking or stimulate their thinking about the immune system of the organisms they're studying?
Yes, sometimes it does. It depends a little bit on who we're working with and how open they are to thinking about their biological system in terms of information processing. I'll tell you one fun anecdote. One of my early students, Stephen Hofmeyer, set out to build an intrusion detection system. Our group developed one of the early practical, what are known as behavior-based anomaly detection systems. So one of the early adaptive intrusion detection systems. So he set out to build one of these intrusion detection systems using principles from immunology. And we started with a very simplistic model of what the immune system did, a model that was so simple that it would offend any practicing immunologist. And he implemented his system and used it to detect network-based attacks in a local area network. So he built the first system, and he had a huge number of what we would call false positives, or what the immunologists would call autoimmune reactions. That is, the system noticed normal behavior and flagged it as being anomalous. And so then he had to add in various supplementary mechanisms to control for autoimmunity and control for other problems. And by the time he finished his dissertation, he had added in an enormous number of these mechanisms that were required to make the system behave properly. And it turned out that each of them had a fairly direct analogy to a mechanism, a known mechanism in the immune system.
That's amazing.
And so, yeah, we thought it was amazing too. And so that work, I think, speaks to this question, a question that immunologists often ask, which is, how much of the immune system is there because we need it? And how much of it is there just by accident? Is the thing kind of just randomly thrown together and not a minimal design? Or is it really a well-crafted, well-organized design where every component is playing a crucial role? This is a question that we all confront when we look at the designs of nature, the extent to which they are minimal, highly optimized designs, and the extent to which they are frozen accidents. One thing I would like to say about that is that these biological systems may not be minimal for the particular job, but as a result of having these kind of natural organic designs, they are much more robust. And so robustness is an important property that computer scientists would like to import. We would like to build systems that are more robust. And by robust, I mean the system keeps working even when it has some unforeseen thing happen to it. So you would like your computer to be robust to being dropped onto a hard surface. You would like to have your program be robust to typing in the wrong kind of input. And when we think about how to design computers that are robust in those ways, I argue, we'll end up with designs that are more like biology and less obviously these minimal, conceptually beautiful designs.
Very interesting. We're talking to computer scientist Stephanie Forrest. Another thing that you're involved with is self-repairing software. I guess this is part of an extension of what you've just been discussing.
Right. So this is a project I've been working on over the past 5 years, and one of my lectures will be devoted to this topic and its relatives. The observation is that we have a huge amount of software in the world. And in fact, some people have written papers arguing that all the code has already been written. Every possible little computer statement has already been written by someone.
Wasn't there somebody who in the year 1900 said they should close the patent office because everything that could be invented has already been invented?
Right. Well, I'm not sure if this is like that or not, but that's a reasonable rejoinder. Anyway, we have a huge amount of software out there, and it's expected to do much more complex tasks than the original programs that were written in the 40s and 50s. And in particular, the software is expected to interact with a wide variety of physical environments and a wide variety of people. And bugs in the software programs are an enormous problem. One old study from NIST from about 10 years ago claimed that 0.6% of the US GDP was devoted to bugs, or that bugs cost the country roughly 0.6% of its GDP.
Wow.
Anyway, it's a huge number, and that number's old and out of date, and whether it's more or less now, I can't say. And it's, in my view, the final frontier for computer programming. We've written programs to do a wide variety of things, and it seems that we should be able to write programs that can repair other programs.
Is that actually happening yet?
It's an idea I had for a long time, and I started working on it seriously in collaboration with a professor at the University of Virginia, Wesley Weimer, about 5 years ago. And I have to say it's worked much better than I ever thought it would. We, in our big systematic studies we've done, we repair over 50% of the bugs we try, and we run the repairs using cloud computing so we can measure how much it costs. And we repair them for under $8 a piece.
Which is dramatically orders of magnitude lower than it would cost to pay somebody to do it.
Yes, exactly. So I'll be going through that data fairly carefully in my lecture and explaining how the method works. I do want to say, though, that the method is based on ideas from biology.
And so just for our listeners, give us a few examples of a software bug and how that messes things up in real life.
A famous bug that we looked at was the Microsoft Zune player. I don't know if you remember, in late 2007 or 2008, right around in there, this was Microsoft's answer to the iPod. They released a device that was essentially a music player. And on New Year's Eve of that year, it was 2008, on New Year's Eve, these devices started freezing up. And it turned out that the problem was traced back to a software bug. And it was an infinite loop in a little section of code that translated the date from the format the computer represented it into a year to be printed out. Like, this is the year 2008. The bug occurred on the last day of a leap year. And so this particular program didn't handle the leap year situation correctly. And as a result, it just entered what's known as an infinite loop, where the program kept running and running and running and never terminated. And that was seen by the users as the device just seized up and wouldn't take input and wouldn't produce output. That's a kind of a classic computer program problem.
And so if you have ever more self-repairing software systems, something that you wrote could go find that without some poor beleaguered person going through millions of lines of code.
Right. And in fact, we tested our system on that particular piece of code.
And it found it.
And it found it in 42 seconds.
Oh my goodness. Those must be great moments.
That was a great moment. Yeah, this project consistently we've achieved better results than I would have expected. And research, I should say, a career in research is a career of disappointments mostly. But every now and then you have a project that goes well. And so this one is going well, and that's one reason I'll talk about it.
Yeah. We're talking about all these analogies between computer systems and biological systems. And like any analogies, there are places where they probably don't work. Like, human beings need fresh air, sunshine, sleep, recreation, stuff like that. Those are probably not things that computer systems need.
Right. I haven't thought too much about fresh air and exercise and sleep for the computers. Maybe the robots, the people who build robots, would want to think about that.
But I mean, do they need to rest?
No, they need power. They need power and cooling. And occasionally they need to be updated. But I did want to mention one limitation of this perspective, especially with respect to computer security, which is privacy. And I think it's not obvious that biological systems are configured to care about privacy. There are some somewhat artificial arguments that we've made from time to time, but generally people's bodies slough off cells and the cells have their DNA in them, and there's no mechanism I'm aware of in biology that is preserving the DNA from being observed by some external system.
Which is why we have laws and things like the Fourth Amendment, because it's not done in nature, so we have to do it through legal means.
I think that's right. Yeah.
So what are some of the concerns with privacy that you see and that you're working on?
One technical problem that I see with privacy is that the technology that we've developed for protecting privacy is encryption. And encrypted data is either completely scrambled or in plain text, that is completely visible. And one of the things I've been interested in over the years and worked on a little bit, and other people are working on, is how to come up with intermediate levels of protection. So instead of having completely confidential data, we might have sensitive data that is hard to access but not cryptographically secure. And the idea would be that, well, there might be some legitimate reasons that encrypted data should be partially available. So imagine a medical record. You would like your medical record to be 100% secure and confidential, but it might be that all the encrypted patient data should be searchable by epidemiologists who are looking for disease trends or something like that. So there's a lot of work in these so-called privacy-preserving data mining technologies.
So like a case like that, maybe your name wouldn't appear, but your age.
That's one thing to do. And then, of course, what comes up very quickly, especially in New Mexico, where we have a small population, is even if your name and your age have been blinded out, if you live in a zip code and you have a particular kind of cancer and you have three children, you might be...
Then you're identifiable.
Exactly. So there's a variety of approaches people are using. But that's an example where I think the designs of nature are not immediately applicable, and we need some kind of intermediate solutions.
Stephanie Forrest, you're going to be going to Washington, D.C. on a Jefferson Science Fellowship. What will you be doing there?
Well, believe it or not, I'll be working at the State Department, which is quite a switch from anything I've ever done in my life. And I don't know that I feel 100% prepared. But the program is sponsored by the National Academies of Science, and the idea is to increase interaction between the academic science community and the State Department. And so I'll be living in D.C. for a year and going to work every day at the State Department and working in one or two groups on issues related to cyber policy.
Do you know what their concerns are?
Well, I know some of their concerns. One concern is how the internet should be governed, whether it should be handed over to a UN-style organization or whether it should continue to be a multilateral set of parties, governments, private companies or public companies, and civic groups. So that's one big issue that's in play.
And then you would perhaps have research about robustness and diversity to bring to that?
Yes, I think I'll bring a unique perspective, which comes from my interest in biology, but also just as an outsider. And I'm going there a lot to learn. The idea is it's an exchange. And so they're very interested in me taking what I learn about policy and bringing it back to the University of New Mexico. So I expect to come back, and I hope I'll be allowed to teach a class related to some of these topics. Other topics are, well, obviously surveillance. Everyone's heard about Edward Snowden, and that's going to have big impact on our foreign policy one way or another. and a lot of the other, well, interactions with specific countries, like China is a big one. And where I get involved with this and what my role is, I don't know.
Well, maybe in a year we will have the chance to talk again.
Exactly.
Stephanie Forrest is Distinguished Professor of Computer Science at the University of New Mexico and External Faculty at the Santa Fe Institute. She will be delivering the 2013 Stanislaw Ulam Memorial Lecture Series on Tuesday through Thursday, September 10th through 12th at the James A. Little Theater. For more information, you can go to the Santa Fe Institute website, santafe.edu. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Oh, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.